This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, An Agent in Place by Robert Little. Copyright 1991 by Robert Little. All rights reserved. Grateful acknowledgement is made for permission to reprint the following. Excerpt from Anna Akhmatova's Voronezh, translated by Stanley Kunitz and Max Hayward. Reprinted by permission of Athenaeum Publishers, an imprint of Macmillan Publishing Company. From Hope Against Hope, a memoir by Nadezhda Mandelstam, translated from the Russian by Max Hayward. Copyright 1970 by Athenaeum Publishers. Excerpt from I Love, the story of Vladimir Mayakovsky and Lily Brick by Anne and Samuel Charters. Copyright 1979 by Anne and Samuel Charters. Reprinted by permission of Farrar, Straus & Giroux, Incorporated. Excerpt from Anna Akhmatova, A Poetic Pilgrimage by Amanda Haight. Copyright, Oxford University Press, 1976. Excerpt from Requiem and Poem Without a Hero by Anna Akhmatova. Translated by D.M. Thomas. Reprinted by permission of Octopus Publishing Group Library. Excerpt from An Arrow in the Wall by Andrei Voznesensky. Reprinted by permission of Henry Holt and Company. Narrated by George Backman. This book contains 303 pages on 8 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Fearing the end of the Cold War, a mysterious, autonomous American agency hatches a plot to thwart changes in the Soviet Union. The Bureau's patsy is Agent Ben Bassett, sent to Moscow supposedly to eradicate all paper traces of a CIA operation called Ironweed. While both American and Soviet operatives track his movements, Ben further complicates the plan by falling in love with a Russian poet. Explicit descriptions of sex and some strong language. 1991. From the book jacket. On the surface, perestroika and glasnost reign, but deep in the concrete fastness of the Pentagon and the bowels of the massive KGB center in Moscow are old cold warriors who refuse to fade away. Yet, how can they wage their battles when there are no enemies anymore? Their answer is Ben Bassett. When the shadowy organization in Washington known as Intelligence Support Activity sends him first to Prague and then to Moscow, apparently as a lowly embassy housekeeper, a series of plots and counterplots is set in motion that leads to the clandestine heart of the Soviet system itself. For when Ben meets by chance a fiercely independent, passionate Russian poet, Aida Zavaskaya, he falls under her spell, and with her is made the pawn in a dreadful game in which the opening stakes are the life of her child. An Agent in Place is Robert Little at his very best. More than a compelling story of international suspense, it is an intricate novel of human character and moral responsibility that the author himself describes as a love story disguised as a spy story, or perhaps a spy story disguised as a love story. An Agent in Place is both, and much more. About the author. Robert Little was born, raised, and educated in New York. A former Newsweek editor specializing in Soviet affairs, he left journalism in 1970 to write fiction full-time. He is the author of 10 novels, including the critically acclaimed The Sisters, The Defection of A.J. LeWinter, The Debriefing, The Amateur, The Revolutionist, and The Once and Future Spy. Other books by Robert Little. Sweet Reason, The October Circle, Mother Russia. For Lou Gillinson. If the past and the future really exist, where are they? St. Augustine. The past is rotting in the future, a terrible carnival of dead leaves. Anna Akhmatova, Poem Without a Hero. An Agent in Place. The first threads of plot I was able to discover date back to the summer of 1986. According to a security log I was not supposed to see, four people whose names would not have meant anything to the general public gathered around a table in a basement room of the Pentagon. The table was metal and covered with frayed green felt, the room windowless, stuffy, remote. This was the first session of a shadowy Pentagon organization listed innocuously as an intelligence support activity. The group had come into existence during the Carter presidency to deal with the Iranian hostage crisis. When the crisis ended, the support activity had been disbanded, but it had remained on the books. It had been resurrected several months before the first session by some middle-ranking Pentagon officers who were intrigued by the fact that the group, which was not associated with the Central Intelligence Agency or the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, was outside congressional oversight parameters. Intriguingly, it was also outside White House oversight parameters, inasmuch as it did not require a presidential finding to set the wheels in motion. Few in Washington were even aware of the support activity's existence. Of those who knew, only a handful had an inkling of how it was funded or who was in charge. Fitting the odd pieces of the puzzle together, I learned that the intelligence support activity's budget was buried in the Joint Chiefs Contingency Fund under the heading Transportation Miscellaneous. The person in charge was a Marine colonel attached to the long-term planning staff of the Joint Chiefs. As near as I can determine, there were subsequent meetings, exploratory in nature, through the rest of 86 and all of 87 and into the winter of 88. The discussions revolved around a series of carefully honed written questions devised by the group's Eminence Grise, a soft-spoken, poker-faced, one-time aide to the president's national security advisor, about where the American military establishment was headed. It was headed, everyone agreed, for disaster. There is nothing more pathetic, the Marine colonel is supposed to have remarked in a comment that summed up the general mood of the group, than a warrior without an adversary. As the winter of 88-89 waned, there was a general consensus that something had to be done. The question was, what? By the time the cherry blossoms along the Potomac had burst into flower, the group was kicking around scenarios, exploring alternatives, checking and rechecking the givens, agonizing over the unknowns. I have it on unimpeachable authority that what was inelegantly billed as the shit or get off the pot session was held in June 1989. At one time or another, I have worked with two of the four men in the room, played poker with the third, and done some serious drinking with the fourth. I have a pretty good idea of how they operate. I think I know their weaknesses and their strengths. I think I know what their faces look like when they hesitate or plunge, which is why it wasn't difficult for me to reconstruct this pivotal meeting, to figure out who said what. The support activity's nuts and bolts specialist, a fat man in his early 50s who went by the name of Marlowe, would have been the one to kick it off. "Suppose we go over it once more," he might have suggested. Knowing Marlowe, he would have loosened a very loud tie and unbuttoned the top button of a very wrinkled shirt. What is the best that could happen? The best that could happen, the retired CIA deputy director who supplied the support activity with its operational expertise, would have explained patiently, is that Ironweed will succeed. It is drastic surgery, I grant you, but the situation is desperate. The Marine colonel, who managed to look military even when he turned up in civilian clothing for a regular Wednesday night poker game, might have remarked, in a manner of speaking, the operation is what our German friends would call an Endlösung, a final solution. I can imagine Marlowe eyeing the group's Eminence Grise with his icy eyes and noting, Henry here has not given us the benefit of his thoughts yet. The Eminence Grise would have been sucking thoughtfully on the stem of a dead pipe. In his middle 70s, his hair silky white with age, he had started what his colleagues invariably referred to as a long and distinguished career as a young OSS field agent armed with a poison pill and one-time pads coated with potassium permanganate, so they would burn quickly if he had to destroy them in a hurry. Those were the days, he liked to say, when Americans still had qualms about reading other people's mail, qualms he made it clear he had never shared. A former head of the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, he was known to be prudent to a fault. Without his assent, there was no chance of the intelligence support activity giving the green light to what had become known as Operation Ironweed. "My obsession in life," the man with the white hair would have reminded everyone, "is damage control. We propose to play with fire. I want to be absolutely sure there is no possibility of our getting burned." Which brings us to the next logical question, Marlowe, a former Prague station chief of the CIA, would have observed. What is the worst that could happen? I can see the retired CIA deputy director removing a pair of bifocals and massaging his eyelids with his thumb and third finger. "I have been involved in a great many schemes in my time, but this one is by far the most imaginative and the most compartmented I've seen. It is textbook perfect from every point of view." Assuming we give him the go-ahead, the agent charged with carrying out our instructions won't have the vaguest idea whom he is working for or what Ironweed is all about, and thus will be incapable of compromising it or us. As a matter of fact, the only ones who can fit all the pieces of the puzzle together are inside these four walls. That's about as tightly held as an operation can get. He looked directly at the man with the silky white hair, whom all of them considered the godfather of the plot. "To dot the I's and cross the T's, the worst that could happen is the Russians will not react the way we expect, and the plot won't succeed. But even then, they will not be aware that it was a plot." The others in the room would have exchanged looks. There was really nothing more to be said. They had approached the problem from every possible angle, anticipated every conceivable snare, weighed and reweighed the risks. An agent had been painstakingly selected, discreetly briefed by Marlowe, who had passed himself off as a State Department security consultant and dispatched to Prague to await the coded signal ordering him to launch Ironweed. If they were going to bite the bullet, the moment to do it was obviously now. At this point, the man with the silky white hair might have shrugged. I can see him screwing up his eyes, something he always did before he plunged. I can hear him saying, "What the hell? Let's take a crack at it." Chapter 1. Welcome to Mother Russia. There were traces of cynicism where such things were usually to be found, at the corners of the eyes, in the pitch of the voice, on the curl of the lips, as if he knew something the others didn't. As if they wouldn't be amused when they discovered it. Welcome to the emotional hardship post known as the American Embassy. He scrutinized the three people who had squeezed into his cubbyhole of an office. "My name," he went on, rubbing the ball of an oversized thumb against the side of an oversized nose, "is Emmanuel Custer. The few friends I have call me Manny. You can call me Mr. Custer. I have the dubious distinction of being the embassy security officer. The purpose of today's session is vaccination." "Against?" Miss Harkenrider asked anxiously. She had been brought to Moscow to teach grammar to the children of American diplomats attending the embassy's junior high school. The last thing in the world she had expected was to be invited to attend a security briefing. What a story it would make when she wrote home. Savoring the moment, for Manny, startling the titulars of diplomatic passports came under the heading of indoor sport, he quietly announced, "Against the Russians, who will certainly try and tempt you to betray your country." The three people in the room, two women and one man freshly posted to the Soviet Union, resisted the urge to look at each other. If they had, they would have burst out laughing. Who was this political Neanderthal guarding the chastity of the American enclave in Moscow? Hadn't he heard of the political prestidigitator the Russians referred to as the Great Helmsman and the resident Americans had taken to calling the Great Houdini? Hadn't he heard of Glasnost or Perestroika? Didn't he know the Cold War was a sun-bleached bone that historians gnawed on every now and then to sharpen their academic teeth? Manny read the expressions of disbelief on their faces. He had seen similar reactions every time he briefed new hands. They memorized a couple of Russian slogans, and as far as they were concerned, the Cold War was over. Peace in our time. The only thing missing from the picture was Chamberlain's umbrella. The embassy security officer coughed up a guttural laugh from the remote corner of his ulcer-prone stomach. The sound conveyed dry irreverence, which was Manny Custer's preferred protective coloring. Most of the time, his irreverence amused more than it offended. But there were moments when he lost control, when his mood slipped across a frontier into outright insolence, which accounted for the pile of ambivalent fitness reports in his service record, which explained why he had been denied promotions someone judged purely on performance would have merited, which also explained why the current assignment was his last posting before early retirement. Moscow, embassy wags proclaimed gleefully, was going to be Custer's last stand. "You are probably thinking," Manny was saying, "that I am treating possibilities as probabilities in order to capture your attention." His bushy eyebrows arched their backs like two lazy cats as another mocking laugh bubbled to the surface. "Consider this. Every word spoken here is being beamed through hidden microphones to those antennas on the roof, across the street." With a toss of his head, he indicated the window, the city, the enemy. "And from there, into the ears of some bilingual Tetchint comrade in an overheated office at the Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti, better known by its initials, KGB. The man sitting on a folding chair between the two women, a diplomat in his early 30s, with disheveled dark hair and the alert, watchful eyes of someone too rational to be passionate about anything, cleared his throat. "In other words," he said, so guilelessly that Manny understood he was being baited, "Big Brother is watching us." A faint smile found its unaccustomed way onto the security officer's lips. He let his gaze stray idly over the desk, cluttered with service records and telexes and hastily scribbled notes to himself, over the paint peeling like sunburned skin from the office wall, over the battleship gray safe with the collection of paperback detective novels stacked on top, over his bookcase crammed with security manuals and bound State Department biographies of Soviet leaders, over the faces of the three who had turned up for the obligatory security briefing. Manny had the knack of scrutinizing people as if they held no secrets for him, which prompted those who didn't know him well to conclude that he was indifferent to the world around him. The truth was less complex. He was far from indifferent. He disliked it intensely. Orwell got it all wrong, Manny said presently. He completely misunderstood the nature of the totalitarian regime. It was never Big Brother who was doing the watching. It was a psychotic father figure who sometimes went by the title of Tsar and sometimes Secretary General of the Communist Party, whatever. Manny glanced at the service records on his desk, noted the young diplomat's name. It was Benedict Bassett, a newcomer to the diplomatic corps, divorced, the father of a 6-year-old son. Bassett had distant Russian roots and spoke Russian fluently. He had been stationed in Prague for 4 months before being posted to Moscow. The 4 months struck Manny as curious. Most diplomatic tours lasted 2 years, many 3. Manny, who collected details the way other men collected lint in their trouser cuffs, when trousers still had cuffs, made a mental note to find out what eggs Bassett had hatched during his stay in Prague, and why the tour had lasted only 4 months. The other woman, Esther Easley, a stenographer replacing a secretary on maternity leave, asked, "Who is this Orwell, and what is his connection with the American embassy in Moscow?" "Mr. Custer here is warning us that walls have ears," observed Ben Bassett, as if Manny's remarks needed to be translated into English. Bassett angled his head and eyed the security officer. "That's what it boils down to, isn't it, Mr. Custer?" "A little bird is whispering in my ear," commented Manny. "He's saying you and I don't talk the same language." He shrugged a heavy shoulder to indicate that he would not let their failure to communicate affect his appetite or his bowels. Reaching into a desk drawer for Xerox copies of his standard security briefing, he handed one to each of them. "Read through this when you have a moment. It lists some elementary do's and don'ts. Kindly sign on the dotted line to indicate you have digested the contents and stick it in my mailbox downstairs." The grammar teacher examined the sheet. "Are these rules something we should learn by heart?" "Security isn't so much a matter of rules as common sense," Manny said. "Vary your daily routine. Don't talk shop outside the shop." He looked pointedly at Bassett. "Contrary to what some of our colleagues think, walls really do have ears. The KGB still has roughly 2 million employees on its payroll, and it has to keep them occupied. Don't accept letters or packages from Russians you don't know, and think twice about accepting them from Russians you do know. This kind of thing happens all the time. Just yesterday, a Russian woman buttonholed one of our political officers in a store and tried to get him to accept a sealed envelope. He quite rightly refused. Don't deal on the black market. Don't order a Sony video recorder from Finland as a favor for a Russian friend, even if you sell it to him at cost. Nobody will believe you didn't trade it for an icon. I certainly won't. Whatever else you do, don't fall in love with a Russian. The KGB has been known to plant what they call a swallow, and we call a dangle, in the path of unsuspecting diplomats, who can then be blackmailed. Give me a written report of anything that smells like a compromising situation. If you have any doubts, report it, and let me decide. If you need something from the Russians, a maid, a language teacher, hotel reservations for a visiting relative, whatever, get it through the General Service Office downstairs. You want Bolshoi tickets? See the folks in the Community Liaison Office. The two of you, Manny indicated the two women, have white badges, which means that everything above the sixth floor of the embassy is off limits. Your green badge, Mr. Bassett, authorizes you to go anywhere in the embassy up to and including the communications bubble, but you'd better have a reason for being there. Also, unlike the ladies who are being housed in the new office building complex around the corner, you'll be living in a compound across the street from the Hotel Ukraine on Kutuzovsky Prospect, which means you'll be more exposed. Your neighbors are mostly African diplomats, but there will be several Russians, and everyone understands they are there to report on what you do and who you do it with. Bassett, who had been skimming Manny's photocopied sheet while the security officer was talking, pulled an expensive fountain pen from the breast pocket of his sports jacket, uncapped it, and resting the sheet on Manny's desk, scrawled his name at the bottom. "Is it all right if I leave this with you now?" he asked. An amused smile pulled at the corners of Manny's eyes as he accepted the sheet. The truth was, he found Bassett's irreverence refreshing. In his experience, most young diplomats panted like lapdogs at the feet of their masters. A ball only had to be tossed to send them scampering off to fetch it. Bassett didn't come on like a careerist. He appeared indifferent to the exigencies of the embassy pecking order and protocol. Custer liked that about him. "You'll have one other neighbor at the Kutuzovsky compound you'll be interested in," he informed the newcomer to the embassy with a playful grin. "Who?" "Me." Chapter 2. Needles of icy air pricked Viktor Protsenko's cheeks as he waited in front of the apartment building for his car. He stamped his feet. He pulled the sheepskin collar of the worn greatcoat around his neck. He drew the flaps of his astrakhan over his ears. He flailed his arms against his sides. He cursed his driver for a scoundrel and a nitwit, and vowed, not for the first time, to send him packing, no matter what excuse he offered. God knows why he put up with Zinkievich, who ground the gears when he shifted and regularly siphoned gasoline from the tank to sell on the black market. God knows why he put up with living in Aeroport when he could have had, for the asking, 95 square meters in a pre-war building off Dzerzhinsky Square, a three-minute stroll from the center. Viktor expelled a lungful of air and watched the vapor billow around his face. He put up with Zinkievich because Zinkievich had once been hit by an assassin's bullet intended for him, and he felt guilty about it. He put up with living in Aeroport because Yekaterina left him no choice, because she preferred one of the cooperative apartments on Red Army Street between the Dynamo Stadium and the Aeroport metro stop, with hundreds of writers and actors and critics and directors for neighbors, and, not incidentally, potential lovers, to the dull desert of a military compound. Her words, repeated often enough for Viktor to have committed them to memory, inhabited by the Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti, people closer to the heart of the city. There was still no sign of his limousine. Zinkievich was exaggerating his time. Viktor toyed with the idea of retreating into the lobby, but abandoned it. The babushka, holding fort at the table inside the door, would take it as a sign of weakness, would smile to herself at the fragility of a grown man who could not tolerate a dose of Russian winter. Viktor's thoughts drifted back to the winter of 45. He had been 16 at the time, but had lied about his age to get into the army before the war ended. The winter of 45 had been colder than this winter. His boots had been thinner. He had had only an army cloth cap on his head and a rough woolen scarf over his ears, and fur-lined sniper's mittens scavenged from a corpse frozen in the ice of a German river they had crossed. He still wore the much-mended sniper's mittens in winter, a sign, no doubt, of nostalgia for the simpler days when he had been able to fight his enemies. Thinking back, Victor remembered that spit had frozen before it hit the ground during the winter of 45, but he could not recall ever suffering from the cold. But then he and his comrades had had other things to occupy them. There was Berlin's Reichstag dead ahead, and the savage house-to-house, hand-to-hand combat to get there. How times had changed. Now he worried about a wife 22 years younger than he was, openly flirting with her Jewish lover during a dinner at the Actors' Union, or the fact that she seemed to have more rehearsals than usual, and they seemed to last longer than usual. One night, with half a bottle of garlic and dill-flavored vodka under his belt, Victor had worked up the nerve to ask her what her lover had that he lacked, but she had only laughed the laugh that always made her sound on the bitter edge of hysteria. "He knows how to make me forget, Victor," Yekaterina had said. "You make me remember." Her voice slipping into the octave she normally reserved for melodrama, she had arched her carefully plucked eyebrows and had added, "I hope you are not having second thoughts about our arrangement." What could he do? Trot off to her father, Victor's mentor, not to mention his superior in the chain of command, with tales of what? Infidelities? Treasons? The old general would wave his deformed hand in the direction of the Kremlin. He suffered from a disorder called Dupuytren's contracture, a gradual curling of the fingers. Catching their first glimpse of the general, newcomers to his service invariably thought they were being summoned. "My daughter's transgressions are trivial compared with the infidelities, the treasons out there," he would mutter in a voice gravelly with age. And producing a bottle of imported bourbon, he would change the subject so abruptly Victor's shoulders would droop under the weight of the things that had been left unsaid. A horn shrilled at the corner. Zinkievich at last. Victor could see him flinging open the door of the black Zill and waving frantically over the roof of the car. Imagine, a chauffeur waving at a lieutenant colonel of the Komitet Государственной Безопасности as if he had forgotten his laundry on the back seat. Victor rolled his head from side to side in frustration as he delicately picked his way over the icy sidewalk toward the limousine. Zinkievich, bareheaded, his tangled hair flying off in all directions, his enormous earlobes beat red, was holding open the front door when he got there. Victor had begun his military career as the chauffeur of a general who always rode next to the driver out of a sense of egalitarianism. He did the same. "The comrade colonel won't believe what happened to me this morning," Zinkievich sputtered as he slid behind the wheel. Gunning the motor, grinding gears, he steered the limousine past an orange and yellow trolley and headed between enormous banks of dirty snow down Leningrad Prospect toward the center of Moscow. He stole a glance at Victor's frozen cheek muscles, almost shouting so he could be heard over the roar of the car's heater, which was turned on full blast. Zinkievich launched into an account of how his wife's sister-in-law had complained of excruciating stomach cramps, how the ambulance sent to fetch her to the clinic had skidded into a fire hydrant, how his wife's brother had phoned in panic from a booth when a second ambulance failed to arrive, how Zinkievich, knowing the comrade colonel would understand that it had been a matter of life or death, had driven his sister-in-law to the clinic in the comrade colonel's limousine, where at this very moment she was probably being operated on for a burst appendix. "In my shoes," here Zinkievich groaned to indicate he was suffering pangs of conscience at having kept the colonel waiting in the minus 24-degree temperature, "wouldn't the comrade colonel have done the same?" So saying, he plucked a leather-covered flask from the bulging pocket of his overcoat and offered it to his boss, his role model, above all his meal ticket. Victor, who was convinced that Homo sapiens functioned more efficiently if they kept a reasonable amount of alcohol in their bloodstream at all times, unscrewed the cap and, tilting back his head, took a healthy swig. "Cognac," Zinkievich noted as he spotted the color seeping back into the colonel's cheeks. "Imported from Paris, France. 3 stars. I still have the bottle in the trunk compartment. The comrade colonel can count the stars himself if he doesn't believe me." "I accept your apology," Victor murmured, wiping his lips on the back of a sniper's mitten. "And I wholeheartedly offer one," Zinkievich shot back eagerly. He hadn't hoped to squirm off the hook so easily. Viktor treated himself to another mouthful of Zinkevich's black market cognac, produced in some basement still, no doubt, and poured into bottles scavenged from garbage bins behind the hotels that catered to foreign tourists. He felt a pleasant warmth in his stomach. "Did you know, Zinkevich, that if it had not been for alcohol," he informed his driver, "Russia would be a Muslim country to this day?" "How is that, Comrade Colonel?" Zinkevich asked. He ran the windshield wipers to clear away some slush. "Didn't they teach you anything in school? It was the Tsar Vladimir who rejected the Muslim faith and converted to Christianity because alcohol was forbidden by Muslims, and who could survive a Russian winter without alcohol?" "Who?" Zinkevich agreed enthusiastically. "Nowadays," Viktor went on glumly, "we need alcohol to survive the summers as well as the winters. But thanks to our bureaucrats, thanks to the great helmsman," he thought, but it was not the kind of insight he dared share with a chauffeur, "not enough of it is available. In the sense that everyone in Russia drinks less than they need to, everyone in Russia can be said to be on the wagon." Zinkevich was impressed by the colonel's logic. "I never looked at it like that," he admitted. In the street, a traffic policeman wearing several layers of clothing and moving with the awkwardness of a stuffed doll waved a white baton, stopping traffic. A mob of workers spilling out of the railroad station, their faces obscured by frayed collars and hand-knit scarves, swarmed across the intersection in front of the Zill. After a while, the traffic light turned green. The policeman waved his baton and shouted for the workers to stop crossing, but they kept coming, a herd of mindless bulls plunging on, heads bent against the cold, against the authority of the policeman, too, grimly pressing forward as if they were walking across an ocean bottom in lead-weighted shoes, without the slightest desire, so it seemed to Viktor, to get where they were going. It dawned on Viktor, observing the scene unfold in front of his windshield as if it were an allegorical play, that the great helmsman and the clever young men around him didn't know about the chaos that lurked in the heart of Mother Russia. The last thing the country needed was perestroika, or restructuring. Let the great helmsman restructure rents, which were last raised in 1928, or the price of bread, which had been the same since 1954, and he would wind up with a bloody civil war on his hands. The unrest in Azerbaijan, in the Ukraine, in the Baltic republics, in Armenia, in Uzbekistan, in the Donetsk Basin would be nothing compared to it. The insurrection that had ousted Russia's last Tsar and had led eventually to the Bolshevik Revolution had started with bread riots. Couldn't the great helmsman see that he was trifling with disaster when he talked of glasnost or transparence? There were things the masses were better off not knowing. Nobody dared speak of it openly, but the absolute necessity of keeping the masses on a short leash was something that Stalin, for all his excesses, had intuitively grasped. Nowadays, this was an unfashionable, even dangerous point of view, but more and more people were coming around to it. Viktor remembered the old general turning up a radio in his corner office one day and pulling his son-in-law over to the window and pointing with his withered fingers to the word Perestroika splashed across a huge banner draped over the facade of the toy store diagonally across the street from the center. "The Frenchman de Tocqueville had a theory about the French Revolution," the old man had muttered. "He noticed the oppressed masses had not revolted until the oppression was lifted a bit and expectations were aroused. What do you think, Viktor? Will our Norod, our dark masses, get a whiff of the great helmsman's stew and take to the streets for their dinner? Will they dine on us?" Then, to Viktor's utter astonishment, the old general had breathed a word that, if overheard, would have gotten the speaker and his auditor instantly transferred to some frozen timber collective in the reaches of Siberia. "Pamyat," he had murmured, "Pamyat is our flame. We must fan its embers for the sake of the motherland. When it is burning bright, we will use it to incinerate the kike intellectuals who are ruining us." Gunning his engine, honking his horn to intimidate the workers crossing against the light, Zinkevich succeeded in nosing the car through the mob. A few minutes later, he pulled up on a narrow side street behind Detsky Mir, the toy store across Dzerzhinsky Square from the massive KGB center. "Will the comrade colonel be needing me again during the day?" "The comrade colonel will not be needing you," Viktor said. but that does not mean you are to cruise around picking up private fares. Zinkevich, who had been Viktor's driver in Kabul in the early 1980s until the assassin's bullet aimed at the colonel had punctured one of the chauffeur's lungs, managed to look hurt. I was planning to get the comrade colonel's car greased and oiled at a new private garage near the exhibition of economic achievements, he said. I heard of some Kazakhs there who used German motor oil, he added, as if it were a critical detail. Viktor knew from long experience that his driver was impervious to sarcasm, but he mumbled something anyway about how he would appreciate Zinkevich being there at 6 o'clock if his sister-in-law's state of health permitted, and started for the delivery entrance to the toy store. He went down one flight, pushed through a pair of swinging doors marked Absolutely No One Admitted, and walked the length of a narrow, well-lit corridor. A uniformed militiaman sitting behind a table at the far end leapt to his feet and snapped off a smart salute at Viktor, who flashed his red identification booklet and leaned over to sign the register. The militiaman inserted the register in a slot so that a camera could read the signature. There was a moment of silence, then a bell rang once, and the door next to the table clicked open. Viktor continued down a long, brilliantly lit white-tiled tunnel, had his signature and identity booklet checked once more at a subterranean entrance to the center, then headed down the marble hallway toward the elevator and his fifth-floor office. His secretary, a prematurely gray-haired middle-aged woman, who had also been with him in Kabul, was laying out dossiers on his desk when he arrived. "My God, it's hot in here," Viktor noted as he flung his greatcoat over the back of a chair. "I take it the thermostats and the radiators still have not been adjusted." He eyed the pile of dossiers suspiciously. "What world-shaking events are waiting in ambush for us today?" he wanted to know. The secretary, whose name was Evgenia Leonovna, handed Viktor a thick file with overnight cables as he settled heavily into a padded swivel chair. "There was a time when you were known as the House Optimist, Colonel Prosyenko," she remarked. Viktor removed his eyeglasses and began cleaning the lens with the tip of his tie. "The peasants have a saying," he told her. "An optimist is someone who does not know enough." He hooked the glasses back over his ears and started reading the first cable. It contained the latest gossip from a KGB stukach, or stool pigeon, in the Politburo secretariat. According to the stukach, the great helmsman had been overheard telling a visiting regional Communist Party delegation that he was going to institute a system of annual fitness reports for everyone holding positions of importance in the government. Promotions would be based on performance, not on whom you knew or how long you had been in the party. Those who did not pass muster, the great helmsman was reported to have promised, would be pensioned off to make way for younger, more dynamic people. Evgenia Leonovna, who harbored a secret vision of herself as the colonel's doting adopted daughter, placed a glass of strong tea on Viktor's desk and stirred in a spoon of her homemade confiture. Viktor swiveled toward a window, heard the chair squeak under his weight, wondered why something as simple as getting a handyman in the center to oil a squeaking chair or turn down a radiator so that his office did not feel like a sauna seemed beyond the realm of possibility. He stared morosely out the window, then focused on the window as he noticed the lace-like crystals of snow etched onto the outside of the panes. It reminded him of the embroidered white curtains that had been in his room when he was a child. He reconstructed the room in his head, effortlessly placing objects in their proper places. He enjoyed reconstructing the past. He liked it when things were in order. Things were far from tidy in the great helmsman's Kremlin. Fitness reports today, God knows what other capitalist innovation tomorrow. In fact, the great helmsman was slowly dismantling the party, which was the bulwark that protected Russia from its own worst instincts. And he was slowly dismantling the KGB along with it. He had already disbanded the center's fifth directorate, which was responsible for unearthing ideological subversion, as if there were no more ideology and no more subversion. Anyone who got in the great helmsman's way, anyone who argued the merits of leaving things as they were, quickly found himself posted to some Siberian wasteland. Even the old general, Viktor's father-in-law, felt powerless to stop the tide of reform. "I am looking forward to my pension," he once confided to his daughter in Viktor's presence. But the way things are going, I very much doubt whether the ruble will buy as much when I get it, whether in fact there will be anything on the shelves to buy. Having stirred the confiture into the tea, Evgenia Leonovna edged the saucer toward Viktor. He bent his head to savor the aroma, then lifted the glass and began sipping the sweetened tea as he shuffled through the cables. Each one produced in him a sort of derision, an angry shake of the head. There had been a street fight the night before in a Moscow suburb. Youths from the Lefortovo district, armed with chains and iron bars, had attacked Armenian refugees living in a dormitory behind a textile factory. The so-called progressive faction in parliament had called for the great helmsman's ouster on the grounds that his program of reforms was not ambitious enough. There had been tumultuous meetings of separatists in the Baltic region who were claiming that the secret 1940 Hitler-Stalin pact ceding these states to Soviet Russia was null and void. There had been work stoppages in the Ukraine, talk of a general strike in Kazakhstan, skirmishes between marauding groups of Armenians and Azerbaijanis in Baku, riots in Lithuania and Estonia, an attack on a police station by stone-throwing miners in the Donetsk Basin. Some Azerbaijani Shiites had been arrested while building bridges across the Araks River to create links with their brothers in Iran, not to mention what was happening in Poland and Hungary and East Germany and Czechoslovakia and Bulgaria. Reading the overnight cables morning after morning had led Viktor to an ominous conclusion. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, created by the blood and sweat of the visionary Bolshevik revolutionaries of 1917, Viktor's father and mother had been in the front ranks, and defended by the blood and sweat of subsequent generations of Bolsheviks, Viktor himself had been in the front ranks, was coming apart at the seams, and there was absolutely nothing Viktor could do about it. The telephone on the desk rang once. Scowling at a photograph of his wife set in a silver frame, it had been taken while they were honeymooning at a Black Sea resort 11 years before, Viktor reached for the receiver. His appointments secretary was on the line, reminding the colonel that the section chiefs of Department 1 had arrived for the regular Wednesday meeting. Viktor, who was the head of the second chief directorate, the internal counterintelligence component of the KGB responsible for intelligence and counter-espionage against all foreigners in the Soviet Union, had been astonished to discover when he returned from Kabul in the mid-1980s to take over his new responsibilities that the men who ran the various sections of Department 1, which kept track of American diplomats, were barely on speaking terms. His first official act had been to replace them with new people and convene a regular weekly meeting in order to coordinate the activities of Department 1's sections. In the space of a year, thanks in large measure to this coordination, Viktor had organized the first successful penetration of the American embassy in Moscow in decades. It happened this way. Section 3, which routinely kept track of Russians who came in contact with American diplomats, had reported that several members of the embassy's Marine Guard contingent had Russian girlfriends. In short order, Section 1 had dangled a swallow before one of the Marines, and he had been hooked. After that, it had been child's play for the case officers of the first section, which was responsible for recruiting and running Americans, to blackmail the Marine into giving them after-hours access to some of the embassy's restricted areas. The penetration would have reaped even more secrets if it hadn't been for the embassy security officer, an old pro named Custer. He had noticed a dropped stitch, had tugged on it, and unraveled the sweater. The swallow had been identified, the Marine had been whisked off to a court-martial, the leak had been plugged. The section heads, settled in seats around Viktor's coffee table, exchanged small talk while Evgenia Leonovna distributed glasses of tea. She did not put out her confiture, preferring to keep it for Viktor. When she had slipped discreetly out of the office, Viktor nodded at the young officer who was in charge of Department 1's third section, a captain with tobacco-stained teeth and a distinctly pear-shaped face that conveyed infinite innocence. His mother had died the week before, and he was dressed entirely in black, with a black armband on the sleeve of his black jacket. His lips were compressed in an appropriately mournful expression. Producing a sheet of paper stamped, "Very secret, no distribution outside of Second Chief Directorate," the captain, whose name was Boris Frolov, began to read in a droning monotone the list of known contacts between Russians and American diplomats the previous week. The usual writers and directors and editors and artists had had the usual lunches and dinners and drinks with the usual cultural affairs officers. There had been far too many contacts for the operatives in the third section, working under strict budget restraints to keep track of. Given his meager resources, Frolov had had his people focus on the more curious contacts. A woman had accosted one of the embassy's political affairs officers while he was shopping at the diplomatic gastronome and had tried to get him to accept a sealed envelope. He had politely but forcefully refused. Questioned afterward, the woman had claimed to be sending news of her father's death to a brother who had emigrated to America. The letter in question had in fact been addressed to her brother and described in detail the father's death from cancer. The woman was not employed in a sensitive industry and was not considered to be in the possession of secret material. Some prostitutes, working under the underpasses that led to Red Square, who regularly reported any contacts with foreigners to the third section, had been picked up by two Americans whom they took to be military attachés, but when the ladies had been shown photographs of all 128 males attached to the American embassy, they had failed to identify their clients. A young woman speaking Russian with what seemed like an American accent had buttonholed a Soviet journalist at a party and offered to trade a Sony Walkman for an icon. Word of this had caused a stir when the journalist said he thought he had seen the woman at a recent American embassy reception. A rendezvous had been arranged and the woman had been photographed in the act. Her photo had been given to the ID team in Section 1, who identified her as an Australian au pair girl working for a Canadian diplomat. The icon had been retrieved, the young woman had been conducted to the frontier and expelled. Slim pickings, Victor noted gloomily. He had been hoping for more, the opening gambit of an intricate espionage game, perhaps, if only to take his mind off Yekaterina's endless exploration of infidelity, if only to divert him from the festering boil that was poisoning the Soviet body politic and ruining the morale of its defenders. Frolov shrugged his shoulders in reluctant apology. It was not his fault if the political climate lulled Russians who would ordinarily have fallen over each other reporting contacts with Americans into believing that the Cold War was over. On top of everything, there was the seasonal element to contend with. In midwinter, most contacts tended to take place indoors, out of sight of people who might still be inclined to report these things to the KGB. Another reason to look forward to the end of winter, Victor commented dryly. The section chiefs nodded appreciatively. Victor turned his attention to Andrei Krostin, the painfully thin captain who ran Section 1. Krostin, who wore a thick hand-knit sweater under his sports jacket to render his thinness less conspicuous, spoke, as he always did, without notes. Absently stroking his neatly trimmed blonde beard, he led off with a detailed description of the activities of Charles Inkerman, the CIA station chief at the American Embassy. Where he had gone, whom he had seen, what he had said to his wife in the privacy of their bedroom. At one point during the week, Krostin had suspected he was onto something important when he eavesdropped on Inkerman telephoning two Russians from a public booth. The calls had been traced to two members of the Central Committee noted for their reformist tendencies. Both men had been interviewed. In the current political atmosphere, the center no longer interrogated. Both had sworn they thought they were dealing with a cultural affairs officer trying to set up appointments for a visiting New York Times columnist. Krostin wound up his presentation with a brief description of the various Americans who had touched base at the embassy during the week. There had been several congressmen and their staffers on a junket, a congressional budget office accountant presumably checking the embassy's books, a delegation of Pentagon aides coming to meet their Soviet counterparts, a handful of visiting journalists, a small army of tourists exhilarated at having traded blue jeans for black beluga caviar. Oh, and there was one other thing. Three new diplomats, two females and one male, had reported to the embassy since Victor's last weekly session. The first woman was named Esther Easley, age 48, on temporary assignment replacing a stenographer who had been sent back to the United States on maternity leave. Easley was married, and her husband, a teacher, was expected to arrive in Moscow at the end of the month. The male diplomat's name was Benedict Bassett. He was single, divorced, 33, a low-level housekeeper for the embassy's arms control inspection team. Bassett had come to Moscow directly from a four-month tour at the American embassy in Prague. He had been looked over by the center's Czech friends while he was in Prague. A swallow had actually made a pass at him, but nothing had come of it, and Bassett, a loner who didn't make friends easily, had been written off as an unlikely candidate for blackmail. The third new diplomat was Sabine Harkenrider, age 28, single, on permanent assignment in Moscow to teach grammar to the American children in the embassy school. Of the three new arrivals, she clearly had the most potential for Krostin and his colleagues in Section 1. She was plain-looking and single, the archetypical profile of someone who could be seduced by a KGB operative. Because she lived and worked inside the embassy compound, the problem would be to get at her. Chances were she would be coming out, it was hoped, before spring, to go to the opera or ballet or participate in one of the embassy-organized cross-country ski trips. Krostin proposed to take a closer look at her then. About this Bassett fellow, Viktor said thoughtfully, the four-month stint in Prague strikes me as a curiously short tour of duty. I noticed that too, Krostin agreed. As a precaution, I have instructed our people in Prague to try and discover what he was doing there, and most especially why he was reassigned after only 4 months. Is that it? Viktor asked. I have one other thing that will interest you, Krostin said. He reached into his leather briefcase for a transcript of Custer's security briefing to the three new diplomats. Here is what he told them. And he read the words that his microphones had recorded. Consider this, Custer had lectured the newly arrived diplomats. Every word spoken here is being beamed through hidden microphones to those antennas on the roof across the street, and from there into the ears of some bilingual Techint comrade in an overheated office at the Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti, better known by its initials KGB. Krostin looked up with something akin to a leer in his eyes. How do you think he found out about your office being overheated? He asked Viktor. With a snicker, Frolov remarked, Perhaps he is listening to us listen to him. For the first time that day, Viktor managed a smile. He had never met Custer face to face, but he had read dozens of transcripts of his conversations, so many that he thought he could detect the insolence in Custer's tone as he baited the ambassador or badgered newly arrived diplomats with his talk of vaccination, or argued with Inkerman, the CIA station chief, who, in a strange twist of fate, had been Custer's superior before Custer was kicked out of the CIA. The truth was that Viktor harbored a grudging respect for Custer. He liked his impetuous orneriness, his imperturbable professionalism, his I-don't-give-a-damn style of dealing with people above him as well as below him in the chain of command. Custer is not listening to us listen to him, Viktor told his section chiefs. He is imagining us listening to him. He is the last of a breed, one of those who figures out what the other side is doing by deciding what he would do if he were in their shoes. Viktor turned his head to take another look at the lace-like crystals of snow etched onto the outside of the window panes. This time the sight tripped a vision, not of his childhood, but of the corpse frozen into the ice of the German river back in 1945. The body had been that of an unshaven Wehrmacht soldier, bayoneted to death by Viktor. Something had coursed through Viktor's veins the day he killed the German that he later learned to identify as adrenaline. It was then that destroying an enemy had become his habit, a high to which he was still addicted. Now, in the overheated stillness of his office, his voice came drifting back over his shoulder. Custer is on his last roll. He thinks that a man needs an enemy to validate his masculinity, to give to all intercourse an urgency that comes only when you confront the possibility that it may be the last. He understands that pretty soon there will be no enemies left, and no Cold War to fight. Even as he described Custer, Viktor understood that he was describing himself. Chapter 3. She was introduced by the chairlady as the last dissident, the last person in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics to hold views so outside the now broad mainstream that the male establishment, puritanical to its corrupt core, refused to permit what she wrote to be published. Her subject, around which she wove spiderwebs of poems, was women, their dread of male violence, their incredible courage in the face of it. Her poems boldly explore the no-man's land of women's sensuality, explore their hunger to be physical with the people to whom they were mentally attracted, to be emotional with those to whom they were physically attracted. The chairwoman, a stout woman with a pince-nez clipped onto the bridge of her nose, leaned closer to the microphone. "It is an honor for me," she whispered, her voice husky with emotion, "to welcome to the House of Architects auditorium the woman many of us considered to be the spiritual heir of our beloved poet Anna Akhmatova. Please salute Zinaida Ivanovna Zavaskaya." The 200 or so women packed into the folding metal chairs of the drab auditorium, the 80 or so others lining the walls, burst into enthusiastic applause. The chairwoman signaled toward the wings for the poet to make her entrance. Stepping out from behind the fire curtain, Aida glanced furtively at the audience, as if she mistrusted the entire proceeding. She was one of those rare individuals who took no pleasure from the stir she created when she walked into a room, but she could not prevent it. Big-boned, well-proportioned, somewhere in her early 40s, she had ample hips and wide shoulders and a broken, badly set nose alive with freckles. Her mouth was generous, her lips thick, her eyelashes huge, her hair bound in a dirty blonde braid that tumbled halfway to her waist. Enormous, melancholy eyes were her most distinctive feature. Aida had a way of looking at people so intently she appeared to be committing them to memory. The first time the poet Akhmatova, by then an old woman, had peered into Aida's gray eyes, she had announced that they conveyed an animal's innocence, which she cheerfully defined as an innocence capable of killing, but never for pleasure. As for Aida's clothes, they were in complete disarray. There seemed to be a riot of colors and textures and forms pulling her in different directions. It wasn't that she didn't care. She did, but not enough to spend time and money and energy to put herself together in what passed for a coherent style. A 1930s pillbox hat with an enormous white feather spiked through it was planted squarely on her large head. Across her shoulders she had flung a threadbare fox neckpiece with a marble-eyed shrunken fox's head on one end. The fox was worn over a quilted satin jacket, which in turn was worn over a faded purple sweatshirt with "What needs restructuring is the relationship between women and men," embroidered in Russian across the chest. On one of her long, strong fingers, she wore a ring that had been given to her by Akhmatova only days before her death, because, so the poet had said, Aida understood the wind better than human speech. Set into the ring's beaten silver was a wedge of agate, a stone that, according to Akhmatova, was supposed to banish fear. Aida dearly loved the ring, but did not believe in miracles. She still lived in terror of losing poetry. Now, with the frayed hem of a thick, black, much-mended ankle-length skirt swirling around the tops of her fur-lined galoshes, Aida strode across the stage to shake hands with the woman who had introduced her. Turning toward the audience, she fitted a pair of perfectly round, steel-rimmed eyeglasses onto her nose, spread some papers on the lectern, and studied them until the applause died away. She glanced at a tiny watch on her wrist. Manufactured in Poland, it had been constructed so that the hour and minute hands ran counterclockwise. If time ran backward, her Polish friend had said when he gave her the watch as a joke, you could go back in time and undo the future. You could fix things so that things did not need to be fixed. Smiling at this conceit, Aida made a mental note of the time and looked up abruptly at her audience. I will read for 1 hour, no more, no less, she announced. I say this so that those of you who are new to poetry readings do not have to worry about me droning on beyond your lunch break. There was an appreciative titter from the crowd. If you are bored or have errands to do or prefer a sandwich to a poetry reading, feel absolutely free to leave. I will not be offended. I have a thick hide. To be a poet in Soviet Russia, to have been a poet in Tsarist Russia for that matter, a thick hide is only slightly less essential than a gift for images. But that's another story. Or is it? In any case, I will try to give you some background on each poem I read. Try, in other words, to set it into time for you. And I will read each poem twice in the hope that I will be saying more than one listening can get at. Flashing a self-conscious half-smile, Aida reached up to toy with a tiny mother-of-pearl earring. So, let us plunge together into poetry. In the late 1970s, the bosses, ignoring the fact that I was pregnant, locked me up in the Serbsky Institute for the Criminally Insane. There was no trial, no sentence, only an administrative decision that Mother Russia would be better off if there were one less poet in circulation. They kept me locked up for a relatively short time, 2 months, 6 days, 9.5 hours, but it seemed to me like an eternity. When I refused to cooperate, I was held down and given injections of sulfur, which caused my body temperature to shoot up 5 degrees. All you can do in such circumstances is toss and turn in bed in an endless search for a position that does not hurt. I do not remember ever finding one. When you first arrive at this so-called institute, you are invited to fill in a questionnaire. It was this questionnaire that inspired the poem I am going to read. The questions were a humiliating invasion of privacy, something like being subjected to a gynecological examination by a drunken veterinarian. I like to think that my interlocutors were not prepared for the answers I gave. So, here is the poem. I call it Q and A. And peering through her granny glasses at a scrap of paper she did not really need, Aida began her recitation in a brittle, high-pitched voice. When did you lose your virginity? To a man or to a woman? Resist the temptation to answer a question with a question. Can you describe your arrest? The police were very polite. They brought me tea with cakes. When I had finished, one of them cleared away the cup and saucer and punched me in the nose. Another fitted on a surgical glove and inspected my anus. What do women want from men? Their dreams and their cocks. Why their dreams? We are the ones who make the day work. We shop and cook and clean up afterward and remember everyone's birthday and bring in a second salary and rear the children and brew herb tea and watch our weight and make love and make babies. We do not have time to dream. Why their cocks? To suck on. What is in it for you? The object of intercourse is intimacy. You think you will know men better if you suck their cocks? I think I will know myself better. Sensuality is not for the faint of heart. Are you afraid of losing your sanity? I am afraid of losing my insanity. I am afraid of losing poetry. What is in the shortest supply in the motherland? Smiles. What is in the greatest supply? Shrugs. Shrugs? Shrugs, yes. You are full of shit. That is not a question. I will rephrase it. Did anyone ever tell you you were full of shit? Many times. Do you agree? What I am full of is unshed tears. Inebriated with poetry, Aida read the questions and answers a second time to an utterly still audience. Then, suppressing a shiver, she drew a deep breath as if she were purging a painful memory. The poem seemed to have cast a spell on the assembly. No one dared to applaud for fear of being irreverent. Shuffling through her papers, Aida selected a second poem. "I do not do this in any particular order," she remarked. "I invent it as I go along. In this respect, a poetry reading imitates life." Aida forged on, explaining the source of each poem, then reading and rereading it in a deliberately flat, undramatic voice. She wanted the words and the spaces between them to convey the moods and meanings and not her tone. She detested films in which the music told people how to feel. The women in the crowded auditorium, stunned by the audacity of the overt sexual references, mesmerized by what they took to be the echo of their own secret voices, hung on her poems in rapt attention. Reciting one of her older poems, Aida forgot a word. Several women who obviously knew the poem by heart called it out to her. Some of the women in the audience could be heard sobbing after she read a poem describing an abortion in such clinical detail that everyone understood it had to be autobiographical. Dozens of heads nodded in agreement when Aida, in 8 barbed lines, noted that the KGB had not been disbanded, that its agents, the great majority of whom were men, were even now copying down the names of those who wrote subversive poetry, as well as those who listened to it. With the hour almost up, Aida glanced at her wristwatch, shuffled her papers, looked out tiredly at the audience. The last poem I will recite is one I stumbled across last night when I was reading through notes I made years ago. Like most of my poems, it has never been published. I had not set eyes on it for years, so it took me a while to figure out where it sprang from. Eventually, it came back to me. I wrote it during the period of stagnation, as our current helmsman calls the Brezhnev years. The poem was inspired by three propositions. The first proposition states that even in the worst of times, and God knows we have had more than our share of the worst of times, sex has been a sanctuary, a place we could retreat to where the state and its police could not follow. The second proposition states that women, like men, have a garden full of lust. But unlike men, we understand that the body can keep people apart as easily as it can draw them together, and that in any case, it is never neutral. The third proposition states that women have a central dilemma about which men know nothing, namely, how to give yourself freely while holding part of yourself back, how, in other words, to be lusty and lucid at the same time. So I call this poem Geography. And she began to read again. Beating the air, she lighted like a butterfly on the leaf of his lip, her longitude to his latitude. Beating the air, she drifted away before he could get a fix. There was an incredible stillness as Aida finished reading the poem a second time, as if the women in the audience, barely daring to breathe, had penetrated to the eye of a storm. A ripple of applause spread across the auditorium. Then the women were standing and clapping rhythmically and stamping their feet. The floor shook. The chairwoman rushed onto the stage to pump Aida's hand. Blushing self-consciously, Aida smiled and nodded her thanks. Some of the younger women in the crowd swarmed forward to thrust copies of Aida's only published book, a thin volume of poetry titled Stranded, up for her to sign. "You were wonderful," one young woman called. "Where would we be without your voice?" another cried. Worn out but exhilarated, Aida crouched and scratched her name in bold letters across the title pages. The postpartum letdown that invariably followed her poetry readings had gripped Aida when she stopped by the office of Novi Mir an hour later to correct the galley proofs of two recent poems and pick up a check from the editor who was proposing to publish them. "If I didn't know you better," the editor, Joseph Mikhailovich, told Aida, eyeing her cheeks flushed with color, "I would think you were wearing makeup. Let me guess. Either you were outdoors too long, or you have been reading your poems to unwashed women in a windy hall." "Both are true," Aida said. "I walked over from the House of Architects." She hiked herself onto a radiator to soak up some of its warmth. The editor, whose long flowing beard and fervent eyes left him looking more like a Russian Orthodox priest than a man of letters, watched as she fitted eyeglasses over her slightly disjointed nose and started to read the proofs. He was toying with the idea of raising a delicate subject. "If you would tone down the feminist rhetoric and remove the word cunt from the third poem you submitted," he finally remarked, "I might be able to get that one published, too." Smiling faintly, Aida looked up. "And what is it about the word cunt that makes it inappropriate for a poem?" she asked innocently. "I was trying to be helpful," the editor said defensively. He had been tempting fate to bring it up, but the damage was done. From the rehearsal studio on the floor below came the muted sound of a soprano practicing scales. Aida gazed at the editor scornfully. "I suppose I should be more grateful. I suppose I should crawl across the floor for the crumbs you throw my way every few months." "It is not a question of being grateful, but respectful." "I wholeheartedly agree," Aida retorted hotly. "More respect is what is needed here. Not only for people, but for poems. Most especially for poems that use what you may think of as dirty words to explore clean subjects. In this case, the proposition that if two people were left on Earth, one would invade the other, which is what you are doing to me now." "I show respect for your poems by publishing some of them," the editor muttered in a voice laced with irritation. "Some of them!" Aida exploded. She flung her head back and blew out air between her lips in a perfect imitation of a horse whinnying. Several junior editors, attracted by the whinny, gathered outside the open door of the office. The editor scraped back his chair and came around to plant himself in front of the desk with his arms folded across his chest. Aida noticed what appeared to be caviar stains on his beard and on the lapels of his checkered sports jacket. The sight provoked her. So, what would happen if your readers came across cunt in print? She inquired sarcastically. Would the earth quit rotating on its axis? Would the polar ice cap melt? What hypocrites you all are! It is prudes like you who refuse to publish stanzas from Pushkin's Tsar Nikita, who even now think Nabokov went too far with Lolita. Admit it, Joseph Mikhailovich. You are afraid of crossing some party line, afraid of offending some male chauvinist cog in the Bolshevik wheel. For a moment, the only sound in the room was the hollow ticking of the wall clock. When will you get it into that virago's skull of yours that there is no party line anymore? The editor lectured her, raising his voice, tapping a forefinger against his own skull. Our poets should be the first to understand this, the first to support those who are risking everything to bring a human face to socialism. Aida slid off the radiator and, producing some cheap tobacco and paper from the pocket of her blanket-lined overcoat, proceeded to roll a thin cigarette. As a young girl, she had worked for 18 months in a cigarette factory in Central Asia and had never lost the knack. The business of poets, she said, as her fingers worked the tobacco onto the paper, is to permanently position themselves to the left of the official line. During the Brezhnev era, we stood for glasnost. Now we must stand to the left of glasnost. It is clearly not ambitious enough if it cannot live with the publication of a poem that contains the word cunt. She licked the edge of the paper and threaded the cigarette closed and thrust it between her lips. You would not happen to have fire, she challenged, her eyes boring into his, and it was clear from the angle of her chin, from the slight smile on her trembling lips, that she intended the double meaning. Shaking his head in frustration, the editor thumbed a lighter and held the flame to the tip of her cigarette. How is it we always end up arguing when we are on the same side? I suppose the answer is that we are not on the same side. The minute hand on the wall clock lurched forward with a resounding click that sounded like a lock closing. Aida checked her wristwatch against the clock. Joseph Mikhailovich shrugged in exasperation. Spare me your feminist song and dance routine, he said scornfully. He caught a glimpse of the editors eavesdropping at the door and turned on them in anger. Don't you have anything better to do than stand around gaping in hallways? He stalked over and kicked the door closed so hard Aida thought the opaque pane of glass in it would shatter. She exhaled a lung full of foul-smelling cigarette smoke. You should be opening doors, not closing them, Joseph Mikhailovich. You know the story about Pasternak on his deathbed. He kept mumbling the same thing over and over, but nobody could figure out what he wanted. Finally, someone deciphered it. He was asking for the door to be opened. That was too much for the editor, for whom Pasternak was a hero, an icon, a god. What is that supposed to mean? Poetry is a moving target. Poets, too. You have to stalk both of them. In other words, Joseph Mikhailovich, it means whatever you want it to mean. What a cunt you are. Aida produced a mocking half-smile. Though the editor could not have known it, the person she was mocking was herself. Another battle had been won, another war lost. Breathing heavily through his nostrils, flicking imaginary specks of soot from his lilac shirt, Joseph Mikhailovich retreated to his fortress behind the pile of manuscripts on the desk. You ambushed me, he complained. He threaded his fingers through his long beard, absently working out the knots. That is the thanks I get for going out on a limb and publishing your poems. Aida grew bored with the game. If you really want to help me, she observed quietly, you can pay me for the 2 poems you have accepted. You know the magazine's rules, the editor told her. We pay on publication, not on correcting galley proofs. You are so hot to restructure the country, Aida replied wearily. Why don't you start by restructuring the magazine's rules? Suddenly she felt overwhelmed by a persuasive sense of despair. She had too many nagging problems, too much on her mind, too many people dependent on her. Everyone took her strength for granted. They did not understand how fragile she really was, how easy it would have been for her to fold her tent and run for the hills, leaving her son and her father and her future ex-husband and all the women's groups to fend for themselves. They did not understand how close she came at times to crossing that delicate threshold where dying seemed easier than living. Stubbing out her cigarette against the wall in a corkscrew motion and flicking it into a wire mesh wastebasket, she tucked her eyeglasses away in a plastic case and gathered her belongings. "Thanks for nothing," she said as she started toward the door. The editor noticed the droop to her shoulders. "How is Sava doing?" he called after her. Aida turned back at the door. "Sava is, thanks to God, all right. It is the world that is sick." The editor smiled in grudging agreement. "Come by tomorrow at 6," he muttered. "I will see what I can do about getting you paid for the poems." Aida stared at the editor briefly, nodded as if she had confirmed some obscure observation on the human condition, and left. Chapter 4. Housekeeping for the Seven Dwarfs, the in-house epithet for the seven officers assigned to the Arms Control Implementation Unit, consumed most of Ben Bassett's time and all of his patience. He shuttled between the unit's shabby warren of offices, located immediately under the embassy's cultural affairs section, and the General Services Office, to the left of the main entrance, and the Marines guarding it. There were train and hotel reservations to be booked through the Управление по обслуживанию дипломатического корпуса, better known to American diplomats in Moscow as the UPDK, and pronounced UPDIC. There were carpool Chevrolets to be reserved, gasoline coupons to be bought, the office burn bag to be disposed of, a visiting fireman from the Pentagon to be shepherded around town. A supply of Pampers had just arrived in the weekly shipment from Stockman's department store in Helsinki and had to be delivered to a woman whose husband was off inspecting Soviet missile sites in Central Asia. The unit's Xerox machine had broken down. Again. The toilet in the office bathroom was backing up into the bathtub. The embassy had been an apartment building in a previous incarnation, which explained why many of the bathrooms were equipped with bathtubs. The apartment building had been constructed after the Bolshevik Revolution, which explained why the plumbing banged when it worked, which was rarely. It took Ben 3/4 of an hour to track down the embassy's resident plumber, and another 15 minutes to convince him that the situation was desperate. By the time Ben got around to collecting his mail in the administrative section, he was wilting with fatigue. He was reading the announcements on the bulletin board. All those who agree there is too much salt in the commissary salads put their John Jane Hancocks below, when a woman tapped him on an arm. "Hi, Ben," she said. "Oh, hello. Sabine Harkenrider?" "I remember your name," he lied. "How are you getting on?" Ben laughed under his breath. "I'll survive. What about you?" Sabine rewarded him with a shy smile, and Ben decided she wasn't nearly as plain-looking as he had at first thought. "The junior high facilities at the new office building are first-rate," she told him. "I came to this job from a New Haven ghetto. For me, having shades on windows is sheer luxury. But the kids here are a bit snooty. The main topic of conversation is the latest killing they made on the black market. They seem to be able to get just about anything in exchange for jeans and sweatshirts." Sabine studied the bulletin board and reached up to add her name to the list of those interested in participating in a cross-country ski outing being organized by the embassy's Weight Watchers the following Sunday. "You don't look like a Weight Watcher," Ben remarked. "I don't look like one because I am one." She glanced at Ben inquisitively. "Do you watch your weight? Do you ski?" "No, on both counts." Sabine, fanning the ember of the conversation to keep it alive, said, "You and Mr. Custer didn't hit it off too well the other day." Ben shrugged. "He ran true to type. He's still fighting the Cold War. It's pathetic." In fact, Ben regretted having baited the embassy security officer. He should be steering clear of people like that and keeping a low profile. "I don't follow politics," Sabine remarked. "I suppose it's because I don't really understand what motivates someone to become a politician." "Power." "That's what everyone says. Power." She shook her head. "There's got to be more to it. It's like saying a businessman is only motivated by money. I don't believe that." She waited for Ben to respond. When he didn't, she said, "Well," and smiled at the ground. She started to walk away, then turned back. There's a happy hour over at Sam's Lounge in the new office building at 4. Come on by, Ben. I'll buy you a drink. Ben thought, the last thing I want to do in Moscow is get involved with an American. He said something about having to see someone at 4:15. Another time, maybe. Sure, another time. Turning away, she smiled again, and then laughed out loud. Ben thought he detected a note of pain in her laughter. He wondered if he had reopened an old wound or inflicted a new one. He did have an appointment at 4:15 with Charlie Inkerman, the Central Intelligence Agency station chief at the embassy. At 10 minutes past the hour, Ben took the elevator to the 9th floor, had his green badge checked by a Marine with a plump baby face crawling with acne, then walked up one flight to the 10th floor and made his way down the hall, past the defense attaché offices, past the deputy chief of missions office, to a door with only a number on it. He knocked and stuck his head in. A young secretary in a flaming red miniskirt was filing documents in a metal cabinet. She waved him into the room. "We're expecting you," she said cheerfully. She threaded a steel bar through the drawer handles and secured the bar with a combination lock at the top and activated the electronic alarm. Drifting over to her desk, she gave Ben the kind of frank once-over that women wearing flaming red miniskirts get from men. "I'm Mehetabel Macy," she announced breathlessly. "You're probably asking yourself what kind of name is Mehetabel. The answer is, it's biblical. It means beloved of God." "It makes you wonder, doesn't it? I mean, if I got posted to Moscow, imagine where the ones who aren't beloved of God get posted." She held up a hand when Ben started to say something. "You're Mr. Inkerman's 4:15. That's what I'll call you from now on, no matter what time I see you. You'll always be our 4:15. Eyeing Ben, she stretched across her desk and flicked a lever on an intercom. "Your 4:15 is here, Mr. Inkerman." An impatient nasal whine filtered back over the box. "Send him on in." The secretary uncoiled herself from the desk and opened one of the 4 doors giving off her outer office and lazily stood aside. Ben got a whiff of lilac perfume as he strolled past her into a murky inner office. As the door closed behind him, cutting off most of the light, he had the peculiar weightless sensation that comes when you plunge to the bottom of a lake. What light there was seemed to mingle uncomfortably with shifting shadows. Gradually, his eyes grew accustomed to the darkness, and he began to make out the CIA station chief. A short, meaty man with strands of hair slicked back in an oily, partially successful attempt to cover a bald spot, he was sitting at a bridge table illuminated by a low desk lamp, manipulating something with his stubby fingers. When Ben approached, he saw that Inkerman was fitting tiny stanchions onto a model of a warship. "Right with you," the station chief mumbled without looking up. He dabbed some superglue onto the end of another stanchion and delicately stuck it into place. Peering at the model through a magnifying glass, Inkerman said, "You're looking at a World War II Sumner-class destroyer named the USS John R. Pierce. She's the one that stopped the first Russian freighter off Cuba when John Kennedy quarantined the island during the missile crisis." Inkerman contemplated the model of the ship with something akin to nostalgia. "I had the great good fortune to be serving on the Pierce at that historic moment in time." Tearing his eyes away from the model with reluctance, he angled the desk lamp so that it illuminated his visitor. "So, you're Bassett," he growled. He didn't offer to shake hands. Ben appeared startled to hear Inkerman pronounce his name out loud. "Just the other day," he noted wryly, "Mr. Custer warned us that wolves have ears." "Custer's an asshole," Inkerman snapped. Gesturing with his head for Ben to take a seat, he walked across the room to a very cluttered desk and settled into the wooden swivel chair behind it. "Fact of the matter is, some wolves have ears, some don't. These particular wolves don't." He reached over and switched on a desk lamp with a green shade. "This office was constructed by Seabees. The windows have double panes to prevent lasers picking off voice vibrations. The Venetian blinds are always closed. Neither the Russians nor your co-workers in the embassy, for that matter, will know you've been up here. If there's one thing we're meticulous about, Bassett, it's tradecraft. You will have noticed that my secretary referred to you as my 4:15. That's because her space is not considered 100% secure. Inkerman, who was trying to give up smoking, planted a plastic cigarette between his thick lips and started to work it in his jaw. I was told you were with Army Intelligence. I was told you could do no wrong. I was told that was all I would be told by my superiors in Washington, by you. Inkerman observed his visitor with thinly disguised hostility. He was not tickled at the idea of someone freelancing out of his shop. Some sort of operation was obviously underway, for the station chief to be cut out of the chain of command was not unheard of, but it was rare. To Inkerman, it meant one of two things. Either he wasn't completely trusted, or the operation in question was especially tightly held. He hoped to hell it was the second, but worried himself sick that it was the first. Still, Inkerman liked to think of himself as a team player and a professional. He liked to say that he only had to be given a compass heading for him to set sail. So, swallowing his pride, he asked, "What can I do for you?" Ben supplied the station chief with a verbal shopping list. He would need the sealed attaché case that had been sent to him in the diplomatic pouch. He would need a room to himself. It didn't have to be big, but it had to be secure. He would need a safe and a shredding machine and a burn bag. He would need access to the station chief's blacklist of enciphered sensitive compartmented information cables, a category so secret the messages were always bigot-listed, which meant that the addressee controlled dissemination and all copies were numbered. Oh, he had almost forgotten his last but not least. He would also need the station's cipher logs. "Anything else?" Inkerman asked with a thin smile. Ben indicated with a quick shake of his head that that would be all. Inkerman asked him how far back he wanted to go in the cable files. Ben said he planned to start with 1967. Inkerman wanted to know what hours Ben would be working. Ben said he would hold down his housekeeping job to keep his cover intact and work on the cables nights, weekends. When Inkerman observed that it would take months to work through the station's sensitive compartmented information cables, Ben only shrugged. As Ben was leaving, Inkerman asked him, "Just as a matter of curiosity, has Custer been briefed about you?" Ben said, "Nobody but you has been briefed about me, not the ambassador, not Custer." Inkerman said, "The Marines checking green badges on the sixth floor keep a log. Custer might find out you've been coming up here. You'd better have a story ready." "One of my housekeeping chores for the Seven Dwarfs involves enciphering their status reports to the Pentagon. If Custer asks, I'll tell him you loaned me a safe to keep my ciphers in and a table to work on when I encipher." Inkerman heaved himself out of his chair. "He won't get a different story from me. You can count on it." Ben could have said, "I am," but he wanted to put some maneuvering room between himself and Inkerman, so he said, "We are," knowing Inkerman would notice the "we" and draw the appropriate conclusion. He did. Chapter 5. Tuesday was not one of Viktor Prosyenko's better days. His gout had acted up again, causing his big toes to swell, obliging him to hobble when he walked. The gout was the result, according to the center doctor who examined him, of having downed several liters of a very bad year of a very bad Georgian white wine the night his wife left for a Moscow suburb. She was on location to film an episode for a television soap opera. Viktor was haunted by his vision of the location. If he knew Ekaterina, she would be spending most of her non-working hours in a king-sized double bed in the local hotel, and she would be sharing it with her lover, the seedy Yid hustler half Viktor's age, who liked to tell anti-Soviet jokes at cocktail parties. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over